Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. As we finished the chanting and began the sitting this evening after this sort of very stately, dignified Pali recitation of the fire sermon, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, strangely enough, the first thing that came into my mind at the beginning of the sitting was Saturday night at the movies. I forget who sang it. Saturday night at the movies. Here we are, Saturday evening. Who cares what picture you see? I realize it was actually a very profound pop song. Yes, probably many people don't remember it or know it. But Saturday evening and closing our eyes to meditate, and then what do we see? And then there's the movies of who I think I am, what I like, what I don't like, what's good about my life, what's bad about it, who I like, who I dislike, what's right with the world, what's wrong with the world, what I want, what I've got, what I want to keep hold of, what I haven't got, what I'd like to get hold of, yada, 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 yada. This is our world. The movies that we see is this kind of array of the inner realm, personality, the body, our own stories, the outer stories of beauties and tragedies of the world around us, present, past, to come, comedies and tragedies, histories. This is like the whole array of movies. Saturday night at the movies, settle down, just watch it all happening. And this is really what it's like. It's what I find is what it's like a lot of the time. And this is, in a way, what Buddhist practice points us towards, is that sitting in the back row of the balcony, not really caring what movie it is. Hugging with your baby in the last row of the balcony. And That in a way, when we talk in these sort of stylized terms about non-attachment or dispassion and so on, but it is really a cultivated art whereby, we're not like completely ignoring the movie, but we're not like bedazzled or enchanted by the plot either. It's in a way. Oftentimes I feel like it's sort of looking down at this tragicomic parade of human life, of what my mind does with certain situations and feelings, and how the likes and dislikes of the body, the comforts and discomforts of the world and people and emotions, personalities, and so on. It's just this kind of the sense of looking down from above, or looking sort of leaning against the back wall, kind of with your feet up on the chair in front, thinking, this is really strange. this whole kind of with a sort of ironic smile on our face, that's observing it, that's kind of looking down on this whole kaleidoscope of unfolding patterns, successes and failures, and loves and hates, and triumphs and crises, and oceans of mediocrity. that we look upon as our lives, and the sense of detachment. When you talk about detachment or dispassion, it's really that sort of looking down with this loving, half amused, half weeping manner, like looking down at the play of the five khandhas doing their thing. Some of them called mine, some of them called the world, some of them called you. This kind of enchanting, tragicomic movie of our world. So when we get it right, it was a kind of bizarre sequence of thoughts that came across my mind. It was like, you know, it is rather like, you know, like in the song, it says, hugging with your baby in the last row of the balcony. So, well, yeah, the Buddha said, you know, friendship, association with the lovely, with the beloved, this is the whole of the holy life. So that, and he said, well, how does one form a friendship association with the lovely, is to practice the Eightfold Path. So in this famous teaching that he gave about spiritual friendship, when Ananda made the claim that the half of spiritual life was Kalyanamita, spiritual friendship, and this is in the light of a discussion where he was maintaining that meditation wasn't everything, but spiritual friendship was half of the holy life. And the Buddha corrected him. Not so, Ananda. It's not the half of the holy life, it's the whole of the holy life. So oftentimes that's taken as a kind of trumpet call of kind of hurrah for spiritual companionship, you know, my Buddhist group and my fellow meditators and so on and so forth. My spiritual companions, in terms of spiritual friends, are as other humans. But as in many of his teachings, the Buddha doesn't just include one level, but he extends it. So that's the thing, spiritual friendship on the external level is the whole of the holy life. But on the internal level, he uses this, he draws this quality that actual spiritual friendship is. He uses the word kalyanamita, like in two senses. So on the one sense, it's friendship or friends who are spiritual. And on the other sense, the internal sense, it's more, it's flipped around. So it's friendship with the spiritual, with the spirit, with the lovely, the kalyana, the beautiful. And then he says, and how does one establish that friendship, fellowship, companionship with the lovely, with the big L, with the beloved, is the Eightfold Path. This is how we cultivate the Eightfold Path, is what brings the heart into association, companionship with the unconditioned, with the Dhamma, with that ultimate truth of the way nature is, the way life is, the ultimate truth of our nature and the nature of all things. So that this is who we should be hugging with, ultimately. Hug the Eightfold Path in the back of the balcony. And this is how we can kind of observe the movie of our life, is that a kind of wholehearted commitment to that training, sila, samadhi, panya, virtue, concentration, mental training, a wisdom. It's obviously it's not having that mapped out or just saying that, as all of us, even if we've spent, even if this is the first contact you've ever had with Buddhism or meditation, at least you've had the last hour of having to be with you're sitting and being with your own mind. So all of us can see that achieving that kind of fellowship with the lovely, that kind of attunement, commitment of the heart to that truth, that unobstructed inner beauty, that fundamental beauty of Dhamma, of reality, is hard, is difficult. It goes against the grain of habit. We have a massive current of conditioning, like a kind of an undertow of conditioning that is pulling us along like a current in the sea that even though the boat's not got the motor going and there's no sails up, it's being churned along at a rate of knots because of the movement of this current of the habits of a lifetime. So so much of spiritual training and the establishment of the heart in Dhamma is about this going against the current, pulling it, kind of resisting the habits of self-concern, of greed, of fear, of hatred, of delusion, of working to counteract that. To know, hey, I haven't got the sails up and there's no engine going, I'm not rowing, but we're really moving here. And do I really want to go in this direction? I've spent the last couple of weeks just staying up in my kuti in the forest here. Each of us during this 3-month rains retreat period during the summer take it in turns for a couple of weeks at a time to be on solitary retreat in seclusion. And so I just had my stint. So I finished on the full moon yesterday. And one of the things that during that time that I found striking over and over was how easy it is to suffer. This takes no effort at all. It's easier than falling off a log. That you just kind of, the boat just kind of gets pulled along that way. And that and I was reminded of a statement that Ajahn Sumedho often makes, which is that whenever I think about myself, I get depressed. This is the great master. This is our kind of, the great white chief of our community, the sort of leading Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, and extraordinarily accomplished spiritual practitioner. And yet, still freely, with a big grin on his face. Whenever I think about myself, when I think of myself, I get depressed. And it became really, the reason why I thought of that was because that was what was happening. Big surprise. And you see, it's like an incredibly simple equation, that as soon as there's me, then there's this oppressed quality. And that everything is wrong. Well, at least not everything's wrong, but lots wrong. Like there's this out of orderness, there's this crampedness of the heart, there's a sense of alienation, there's this kind, there's a fear, basically. Fear of somehow being wrong, that I've got it wrong, or I am wrong, or I'm not worthy, or I'm not trying hard enough, or I'm not loved, or I can't love, or I'm too lazy, or I'm too stupid, or I'm too obsessive, and that these the more I would look at it, the more I would see that it would just boil down to that. It would take up some kind of individual pattern, some particular coloration, you know, whether I'm too busy or too lazy. You know, it's sometimes blue, sometimes red, sometimes pink, sometimes black, sometimes white, sometimes yellow. But whatever, as soon as I am something, then that oppression, that cramping of the heart would be there, that sense of wrongness, tension in the being, in the field of experience. And it really came to so clear that, you know, intrinsic in that just that feeling of I, along with the sense of self, it's very nature of that the feeling of self, even when it's sort of so subtle you can hardly even detect it, it's like that the kind of gratification of I, the feeling of being that is there with the sense of I, its partner is fear. It's like the two sides of a coin, that you can't get one side of a coin. Like Ajahn Chah would say, you know, when you hold up your hand, you have the front and the back of a hand. Well, you know, you pick up a clock, you've got the front of the clock, the back of the clock. You can't just pick up the front of the clock. You know, or you can't, when you pick up a coin, you pick up the heads and the tails. It's just, that's the way it is. And even if you slice it down the center, you know, you still got, you know, you got the tails there, and you got the where the heads were, but there's still, you got two sides. You have to get both sides with it, and the intrinsic in that feeling of self, even if it's not even articulated as a I am or a me or a mine, doesn't even get anywhere near the verbal realm, but just the gut feeling of I-ness and me-ness and mine-ness, then right there in it is fear, because as soon as there's me, which is separate from the rest of the world and the rest of nature, then there's threat, because there's that which is not me. And as soon as that false barrier is created, then that is threatening. You know, it can be, you know, alluring as well, but the most instinctual reaction is threat. In one of the, both biologically, that's the case. The most rudimentary nerve systems that we have are the pain receptors, that which is, you know, keeping us away from danger. But also, it was interesting in that one of the Upanishads begins with a passage that says something like, probably doesn't say exactly in the beginning, but more something along those lines. Like, originally, there was only the mind of the Absolute at rest in the infinite void. And then in the mind of the Absolute, there arose the thought, I am. Mm-hmm. And as soon as there was a thought, I am, there arose fear. And on the arising of fear, there arose desire. Something, so then the desire for something to fend off the danger, to fill the gap, to provide the missing piece. So that is really intriguing, seeing how just the most sort of subtle and coarse ways, grabbing different objects over and over again, they just seem that it's the basic relationship self, the feeling of I and fear. And maybe this is one of the reasons why we chose to call this monastery Fearless Mountain. And the Buddha Rupa, you know, this gesture, the mudra of the right hand up, is like, is fearlessness, abhaya, no fear, free from fear. Because that, what you find, like in a way, if one uses that feeling of fear as a signal, that's the sort of the dukkha signal that tells you, you know, that, oh, you know, some ignorance has clouded the picture, therefore the feeling of I has arisen, therefore is now fear, then that, if we take that as the signal to respond, then we train the heart to let go of that. There's that recognition of that ignorance being there, and that we don't have to abide in that. As long as we stay in that realm of like trying to make me right with the world, and obviously there's a whole massive array of psychologies that work on this basis, and, you know, some very usefully and effectively, but if it stops there, it's just trying to make, you know, get the right relationship between me and the world. Like one of our friends, Tan Punadamo, says it's rather like rearranging the furniture on the deck of the Titanic. You know, you can do a certain amount of, you can make certain arrangements. You can make it, you know, work better this way or that way, but fundamentally, you know, the ship is going down. So exactly where you put the furniture really doesn't matter that much. So maybe that's a bit of a rough analogy, but it's something like that, because and no matter how we try, how hard I try to make things right between me and you, as long as there's a solid me and a solid you, then it's fated, it's blighted, it can't work, because the very meanness and you-ness is fundamentally non-existent. It's not there. That's not the whole picture. So when we try and solve the dilemma or the discord in those terms, then we're always slightly missing the beat, or we're on the beat for a second and then it's slipped off. It's kind of missed again. There's more dukkha. So this is, in a way, we use this signal. We see that, you know, how we have a huge array of strategies of getting away from that fear, that sense of threat, that feeling of ego death. We have, you know, vast varieties of distractions and compulsions to get the attention away from that horrible feeling of me under threat, me incomplete, me imperfect. And, you know, you can just get drunk. You can go to the movies. You can get, you know, really good movies. You can have good, you can have noble causes that you adhere to. You can have meditation techniques. You can fill the mind with useless information or useful information. All kinds of things that we can do. You can hate someone. You can have unrequited loves. You can have requited loves. We can find, you know, 10,000 different ways of getting the attention off that. And, you know, a huge amount of our life and the economies of the world are built up around fending off that feeling. And, you know, many things that are useful can come out of that. But really, when we're talking about spiritual practice at its most core level, what's needed is to, you know, understand what the process is. And it's just not just a matter of evading that death feeling, that ego death. It's not a matter of evading that threat or denying that threat, swamping it with life affirmation, but understanding it. When we look at the Buddhist scriptures and the Buddhist mythology, the Buddha's response to death, to Mara. You know, Mara is the embodiment of unwholesomeness, the realm of desire and death. Mara literally means death, and is a sort of Satan figure of the Buddhist canon. You know, when the Buddha is assailed by Mara, when Mara tries to trick the Buddha or kind of seduce him into getting greedy or getting self-deprecatory or tempting the Buddha into kind of evading his responsibilities and so on and so forth. The Buddha doesn't just shut his eyes and go into jhana and ignore Mara. He doesn't attack Mara with some kind of super duper transcendental thunderbolt and just blast Mara to smithereens. He doesn't go into negotiation and try to be reasonable and discuss things with Mara on Mara's own terms, or doesn't kind of try to justify himself. What do you mean? And Mara says, you know, you're really wasting your time here. You know, you could go back and run a decent kingdom. I mean, now you're enlightened. You could run a kingdom. You could do it totally skillfully. Never been done before. You could set a whole new theme, a whole new pattern. Righteous monarchy. You could have a great thing to do. How to lead a country completely skillfully. That would be a great thing. Why don't you go and do that? So the Buddha doesn't justify himself. He doesn't attack Mara, doesn't blast him, doesn't ignore him. So the response to death is not just life affirmation. It's not just ignoring Mara and getting reborn in something else. It's not denial. It's not revulsion. But the response that the Buddha makes, you know, over and over and over again throughout the scriptures is this very clear, very cool, utterly unintimidated response, you know, that comes straight from his heart, which is, I know you, Mara. O evil one, cousin of the negligent. You have come here for your own ends. I know you, Mara. And then, you know, of course, it's myth. It's not. One can kind of debate this as being, you know, historically accurate or not, but it's a myth, and as such, it has its own meaning and power. But over and over again, as soon as the Buddha responds in that way, Mara knows that the Buddha's seen the trick. He knows there's a hook inside the bait, and he's not going to bite. Or he might eat the bait and leave the hook. I know you, Mara. I know what this is. And then Mara is defeated in that gesture of knowing. This is a really important pattern for us, that the response to death is not, you know, or the opposite to death, or the, you know, the way that we meet that death feeling of loneliness, of failure, of laziness, of obsessiveness, of delusion or weakness or doubt, or, you know, name your favorite flavor, you know, whatever our own disposition happens to be. Not by being born into something else. The opposite of death is not birth. It's not life affirmation. It's not trying to destroy death. It's through understanding. The response to death is wakefulness. I know you, Mara. It's waking up. So it's like a radical non-contention. Because as soon as we contend against death, then we've bought into the whole value system. We've bitten the hook. The hook is in. As soon as we hate death, we fear death, we want to get away from death, we want to swamp it with life, the hook is in. Mara's won. As the Buddha said, you know, if we've gone over to Mara's side and the evil one can do with us as he likes. Shouldn't laugh. Been there often enough. It's a miserable place. You know, the hook is in, and the angler can play with us as he chooses. We can run with the line as far as we like, but the hook is in. So this is the guidance for us. Like, to practice that radical non-contention. So non-contention just doesn't mean being passive or switching off. It doesn't mean denial. But there's a full awareness, but a radical non-contention. Like the Buddha, as soon as the Buddha refuses to fight with Mara on his own terms, then Mara's defeated. He's known, but the Buddha's not going to pick up the weapon. So another instance where the Buddha's being heavily criticized and people are kind of speaking against him or misinterpreting his teaching and vilifying him. And he says, I do not contend with the world contends with me. And this is, in a way, the most sort of radical and liberating attitude of heart that we need to establish, is that radical non-contention, that not contending against the world around us, not contending against other people, not contending against our thoughts, our feelings, our passions, our restlessness, our doubts, the whole, all of the things that we don't want to be around or we feel unwholesome or unskillful. In terms of spiritual training, we often pick up these attributes of our life, the chattering mind, the restless mind, the habits of passion and fear, the habits of hatred and resentment and greed, righteous indignation, all our favorite villains, internal and external, that we've got absolute justification to be negative about. It says in the book, destroy greed, hatred and delusion. or our kind of unloved exes or dark figures in our lives, the kind of wielders of painful influence in our worlds, political leaders that we love to hate, that we've got absolute justification, lists of criticisms of, completely backed up by names, dates, places, facts, sheaves of them. All of that is just the hook has sunk right in, and we've taken up that attitude of contention. So it's a very subtle kind of practice, but it's pertinent internally as well as externally. It's not just a matter of how we deal with the thought of our ex-partner or our mothers and fathers or our political leaders or our fear that our beloved is going to walk off or is looking at somebody else, or who's going to die first and get left behind. It's also equally relevant internally, within our own minds, that quality of meeting the movie, the internal movies with wakefulness, not contending against. We're not just blindly letting the habits of the chattering mind run. We're not just letting greed and fear and anger go rampant. But this is really important to understand that non-contention just doesn't mean a passivity. There's an effort that we make. We work with the negative habits of mind, passions, thoughts, emotions, feelings. We work with them, but we're not contending against them. So it's not like the Buddha says, okay, Mara, it's all yours. Not at all. The point is to defeat Mara. But Mara is defeated not through contending against Mara. It's difficult to understand. But as soon as we kind of take on Mara, on Mara's own terms, we've lost. the heart has lost. It's kind of bored into the realm of birth and death. And then the mysterious thing is by this quality of wakefulness and the refusal to contend, that then that conquest happens. So what it means is that we are responding to working with the effort of training the heart to let go of the chattering mind, to steer the attention towards objects of concentration, to let go of anger and fear and greed, to cultivate and strengthen loving kindness, wisdom, compassion. But these efforts are being made, but the whole thing is embraced in this entire atmosphere and environment of non-grasping and non-contention, so that there's whenever there's something there that we look upon as unwholesome or obstructive or unskillful, we don't allow that the heart to drift into that creation of otherness, of creating it as something that needs to be pushed away or destroyed or wiped out. Well, this is tricky for us to do, but this is such a helpful principle to really imbue in the heart, that to investigate for ourselves, how does this thing work? Because when we think of non-contention, the habit will be to look at it in terms of passivity, just kind of lie back and ignore the movie. Can't you have another cuddle? Ignore the movie altogether. Non-contention. Just let the whole thing roll over us. That's not it. It's a complete acceptance of the way things are, and in the same breath, in exactly the same gesture, making the effort to cultivate the wholesome, to sustain the wholesome, to restrain the unwholesome, to let go of the unwholesome that's arisen. That these efforts, the right efforts, are being made, but not with a kind of dualistic attitude of mind. And that we can only get the feel for that through direct experience. We can't find how to do that unless we're actually kind of working with it for ourselves. Actually, we kind of jump in and swim for ourselves. We really explore that to find how can we do that. How can we meet with the unwanted, the unloved, the unlovable, and not be swept along by it, not fighting against it, but to know it and to transcend it. Yeah, this is the task, at least as I see. I mean, there's dozens of different ways of expressing it, but this is really the task before us. And that just by taking a simple principle of non-contention, just using that as like as a flag, we can note, we can be aware of all of the habits of contention that arise within us. You know, as soon as the heart drifts into it shouldn't be this way, I'm all wrong. How come I did that? Or how can she be that way? Or he shouldn't be like that? Or the world shouldn't be this way? Just like, oh, right, contention, look at that. And then using that flag to bring our attention to it, and then respond to that drift into contention with just waking up, just trusting. When the heart wakes up, when we invite the Buddha into the picture, when we energize the heart to respond in that way, I know this, I know you, Mara, I know what this is. Then, in that gesture of, I know you, Mara, seeing what comes about, seeing what arises from that, how it transforms things. You know, the passion might still be there, but we understand it, we're not sucked into it. the motivation to cultivate is there, and we make the effort, but we're not identified with it. And we see for ourselves, oh, that's how it works. This is the manner. So, using that quality of wakefulness and seeing for ourselves how that happens, how, like, in terms of the using the Buddha as the archetype, what gesture the Buddha makes in the face of that, or in that face of that waking up, what happens? Does the Buddha stay still? Does the Buddha move forward? What happens in each moment? What's the gesture of response? And we see that it looks after itself. And we just trust that awakened heart. Then we know, oh, do something, act now, or shut up. Go left. Do not enter wrong way. Well, you could, but it's really going to hurt. The heart knows. And then just over and over again, following that, trusting that. And then sometimes the world really screams at us and kind of demands our reaction. Mara is really yelling at us to buy in to the program. The bait is extraordinarily tasty and alluring and compelling. And yet, that there's this, this absolutely perfect aplomb resolution that the Buddha has. This never picks it up, never buys into it. That's the symbolism, that's the example that the Buddha of the scriptures brings to us. It's outlining that dimension of our own being, which is of that same kind of utter poise. Like another of the stories of the scriptures where the Buddha is being harassed by a pompous Brahmin for... and criticized for being an alms mendicant and disgracing his clan and causing people to be deluded and walking around the street homeless beggars and a blight on society. And the Buddha asks the Brahmin, and this is after the Brahmin's brother, who had exactly the same attitude in typical sort of Theravada scriptural style. The first brother comes along and does this whole kind of diatribe against the Buddha, and the Buddha says a few words, and boom, the first brother immediately says, oh, how can I be so stupid? Becomes a disciple. So then the other brother, who's even angrier than the first one, gets really upset and goes in and wades into the Buddha. And then the Buddha asks him, well, if you have visitors who come to your house, do you offer them some kind of refreshment or some sort of snack or some sort of meal of some sort? He says, well, yes, of course. The Buddha said, well, if a person comes and they decline to receive what you offer, then the food that you are offering them, to whom does it belong? So it belongs to me, of course. And the Buddha says, well, in exactly the same way, you offer me your anger, but I don't accept it. Therefore, it belongs to you. So he's not. There might have been half a smile on his face. I could easily imagine that. But he's not contending. But he's absolutely refusing to pick up this red flag that the Brahmin is waving in his face, demanding him to pick up the gauntlet. And the Buddha's like saying, "No, it's your glove, mate. You threw it down. You pick it up. I don't. It's nothing to do with me. Your business." As soon as we miss that and we nibble the bait and we get the hook in, then we find ourselves over and over again just our very efforts to train ourselves to cultivate spiritual life is actually taking us in the opposite direction. It's really it's sort of tragic. It's part of the tragic part of the tragicomic is how we in our efforts to create good, we create harm for ourselves. Like Ajahn Mun's Ballad of Liberation from the Five Khandhas is full of references to this. That it's a great obstacle to the practice, this clinging to good and constant fear of bad. So it's, you know, over and over again in different ways he kind of emphasizes that. You're wanting the good, rejecting the bad, this only further entangles the heart. Or in the verse of the third Zen patriarch, when we try to stop activity to achieve passivity, our very efforts fill us with activity. Now this is the tragedy of the religious world, is that we have all these structures and make all this noble effort, and we have customs and traditions and the forms and rules and incredible noble aspiration for all of us, lay community, monastics alike. Incredible efforts we put in doing retreats and keeping precepts and serving and helping and cultivating unselfishness. But if we pick it up in the wrong way, then the very effort that we make, our kind of very religiosity, becomes an obstruction to the effort that we're making. Our very eagerness to destroy the wrong in our mind, the kind of unruly thoughts and the ugly passions and the anxious fears and wiping out doubt and hatred, it only compounds the whole mess. I think all of us have had kind of painful experiences of this. When we want to destroy evil, the very effort to destroy creates more of the same pain and darkness. There's a great story of Dostoevsky's. It's one of the chapters of the Brothers Karamazov called, it's a story that one of the brothers has written, and it's called The Grand Inquisitor. Probably a few of you are familiar with this. And the plot, in short, is that it's set in Spain in the time of the Spanish Inquisition, and Torquemada, the head of the Inquisition, is a sort of very grave, tall, gaunt, 90-year-old monk. And he's just come from some kind of nasty examination of some variety of miscreants in the court of the Star Chamber, extracting the truth from the unbelievers. And he's walking across the plaza in the city, and there's this whole, on one side of the plaza, and there's this commotion going on by the steps of the cathedral. And he sends one of the monks who's with him over to go and find out what all this hoo-ha is about. And they go scuttling over, and then they come back. And after a while, he says, Venerable Sir, you'll never believe this. This is incredible. But the Messiah has returned. He's just raised a little girl from the dead on the steps of the cathedral. He's come back. It's him. It's really him. And then and Dostoevsky describes Torquemada kind of straightening his spine, kind of looking over across the courtyard, and the thoughts move and turn in his mind, trying to decide what to do. Eventually he kind of takes a breath and says, "Seize him." And they arrest Jesus. And then there's this extraordinary dialogue between Torquemada and Jesus in the prison, where Torquemada's trying to explain to him that this is really not the best time to come back, and that he's going to really screw things up, because they've got a really good thing going now, and there've been a lot of troubles in the church, and they're just getting it all cleaned out. And if he comes along and does this whole kind of miracle thing, and the second coming, it's going to just throw the whole plan, the whole well-formed development plan completely out of whack. And so he's sorry, he really regrets it very deeply, but I can't release you. It's well worth a read if you've never seen it. But it's a real heartbreaker. But it maps out, this is what happens. You get so obsessed with purifying our mind, trying to make me pure, trying to make me harmonized with the world. We try so hard at making it all right, loving good, fearing and hating bad, that we end up imprisoning the Messiah. Very reasonably, I'm sorry, but you know, you're an evil thought and I've got to wipe you out. But we end up obstructing and suppressing kind of the very thing that we're trying to do. Through the, you know, Torquemada thought he was doing the right thing. That's the painful irony, is that we're good in, there's good intention and a faithfulness to a system plugging away, but then that very sense of self that has been invested in that, that very imputation of solidity, that very contention against the bad or the wrong or that which shouldn't be, is actually feeding that alienation. And the amazing thing is that even though that sounds pretty dense, that and it's obviously, you know, it's a familiar bitterness to all of us, it's totally curable. This is one of the most wonderful, marvelous, amazing things about Buddha Dharma. We cannot get so lost that it's irremediable, unremediable, irremediable. Mm-hmm. This is the day after the all-night sitting. One of those words. It can be fixed. It's fixable. If you think about, again, talking about Mara, you would have thought if you'd been Satan 37 times, you would have racked up a pretty hefty pile of bad karma, right? 37 lifetimes, and long lifetimes, obviously. You know, Mara has kind of a decent lifespan. 37 lengthy lifespans of being Satan. It's a heck of a pile of bad karma. You think, you know, you'd never get out of that. The Buddha's second disciple, Mahamoggallana, at least according to the mythology, was Mara 37 times. That's pretty amazing. Here's not only an enlightened disciple, but the Buddha's second disciple, like, you know, right at the top of the heap. 37 times Mara. And even you think, well, yeah, that's just fairy stories. But still, even the symbol of it, I find immensely powerful. That not only is that workable, but it's, you know, that it's, you know, so workable to the point that you can end up as one of the great disciples of the Buddha, and totally helpful and, you know, and benevolent, radiant presence in the universe, helping to you know, to liberate so many other beings. So, you know, we might think that my mind, with its kind of disgusting aversions and its gripes and its fears and its insecurities and its horrible doubts and its seething, unspeakable passions, it lusts that we hardly dare think about, talk about. If you compare, like, our little collection of nastinesses against being Mara 37, for 37 lifetimes, you think, well, I've been at least 38, I'm sure, and yeah, I'm so... But just put that aside for the moment. But just that, you know, we can, if we measure it, this, the kind of degree of unskillfulness that we've followed in our lifetimes, and the incredibly stupid things that we've all done, just using that simple example of Mahamoggallana, we say, yeah, it's workable. Nothing is unfixable. All it takes is that gesture of waking up, that gesture of, I know what this is, I know you, Mara, to respond to that kind of the death clamp of on the heart of, I know what this is, I know you, Mara. The responding to that ego death by wakefulness, by knowing. Then, in that very moment, the heart is freed. That's all it takes. That's the gesture of the Buddha. Well, like today we did the Angulimala protection, which is a protective verse, a paritta, that's done for expectant mothers. And you think, you know, well, there's some sort of special protective verse for mothers and their babies to be born. you know, oh, how sweet, how kind, how gentle, what a beautiful, utterly sensitive, kindly, you know, gesture in the universe. But you might notice that it's the Angulimala protection. Angulimala was a mass murderer. Again, according to the stories in the time of the Buddha, he killed 999 people. He was a bandit chief. And he was on the way to kill his mother, who happened to be the thousandth victim to be, just happened to be his mother. We thought, well, okay, I've got to make my thousand today. And then the Buddha intervened. And Angulimala became one of the Buddha's disciples and an arahant, you know, after having killed hundreds of people. And he used to, Angulimala means garland of fingers. He used to cut their fingers off and wear them as a garland around his neck. Pretty gory kind of a guy. So not only did he become an arahant, but then, and I find this a very, very lovely, beautiful kind of twist of the tale, but one day on his arms round, he was walking through the town and he saw this woman trying to give birth to a child, and she had been in labor for many, many hours and was in terrible agony, and the child was unable to be born. And it was this incredible, painful scene that he saw, and his heart was really broken by this. And so when he got back to the monastery, he told the Buddha what he'd seen, and the Buddha said, well, go back to that woman and say to her, since the time that I've been born, I've never knowingly hurt, I've never knowingly taken the life of another living creature. By the power of by the truth of this statement, may you and your child be free from suffering. And then Angulimala said, but venerable sir, indeed, wouldn't this not be an untruth? Because I've taken the life of many living creatures. And the Buddha said, well, then say, from the time I was born in the noble birth, Arya Jati, the noble birth, I've never knowingly taken the life of another living creature. By the power of this truth, may you and your child be at ease. And so he went back to the town and he recited this verse to the woman, and she gave birth to her child easily and with no further problems. And so from that time, this verse has been recited as a protective paritta for expectant mothers. And so it's a wonderful thing. I find it beautiful irony that the mass murderer has nature has so changed, or that the recognition of that fundamental purity of that being's nature has sort of emerged as a complete flip side, from the destroyer of people to the protector of babies. That kind of redemption, that turnaround, that quality is embedded there within that principle, and so that his name is synonymous with the protection of the utterly helpless and vulnerable. And 2,500 years later, that's still the spirit in which his name is invoked. So there's hope for all of us, in short. So I'll leave that there for this evening.